it is really wonderful to be here, and I want to thank the organizers for giving me the honor of participating in a really special and important conference, particularly at this moment in history. I'm going to talk, I've been talking about Lorraine Hansberry pretty consistently since September of 2018 with the publication of Looking for Lorraine. I'm going to talk about her in ways today that are particularly relevant for the subject of our concern, her politics, and how she lived them and how they infused her work. And perhaps, I'm going to try to say something useful about what she has to offer to us today. Before I get there, I just have to be a little bit nostalgic about being in this building. The first time I was in this building that I can recall, I was 10 years old, and it was the night that Harold Washington won for mayor of Chicago, 1983. And the reason I remember it is in the parking lot. I was coming from a concert with my dad, and in the parking lot, a woman ran up to us and said, "He won!" and started hugging us. It was a very emotional moment. And then the most recent time I was here, I brought a group of students to the 50th anniversary of the Freedom Writers Conference, which was held in this building. And so, for whatever reason, this this building is associated with extraordinary moments for me. It's especially meaningful to be able to talk about Lorraine and her birthplace. She was born in Chicago in 1930. This is 60 years since A Raisin in the Sun appeared on Broadway and revolutionized American theater. So she's the first Black American woman to have a play produced on Broadway, the youngest winner of the Drama Critics Circle Award. There have been three film versions. It is the most of the play. It is the most widely produced play by an African American woman in American history. And yet, prior to the Sighted Eyes, Feeling Heart documentary about her life, which I highly recommend, and the publication of Looking for Lorraine, there has been relatively little known about her life. There are several other biographies coming out in the next couple of years, and I urge you to look for them because they promise to be extraordinary. And in addition to there being very little known about her personal life, there's even less known about her political life and her very explicit identity as not just a socialist, but as a feminist, and as someone who believed, who was kind of aggressively anti-colonialist in her politics. And the way that she came to these politics is interesting. So she came from a relatively affluent family on Chicago's South Side. Her father, Carl Augustus Hansberry, Uncle Leo, was a professor at Howard, but her father, Carl Augustus Hansberry, was known as the Kitchenette King in The Defender. And so you may be aware of this, many of you are probably aware of this, but Chicago, in the context of the early 20th century, when there were thousands of migrants coming to Chicago from the Deep South, the majority of the city was covered by racially restrictive covenants. And so the square footage of where people could live in the city, African Americans, was very limited. And as a consequence, Carl Hansberry, along with some others, devised a plan to accommodate the large numbers of migrants by taking what were three family apartments and turning them into nine-unit apartments, kitchenette apartments, and they would have be relatively small and have a tiny kitchenette and a hallway bathroom. And the conditions were quite unpleasant for kitchenettes. There were complicated feelings about Carl Hansberry in the Black community. While he's talked about in the press in very positive ways, I saw one of Lorraine's closest friends from elementary school recently, and met her at a book talk, actually, and she said, "Yeah, but we all knew he was a slumlord." So to make sense of how she becomes a radical was an interesting part of the journey of this book. One piece was certainly that there was actually a Communist Party activist named Ray Hansborough, who lived in their building at one point, and a black member of the Communist Party who was a mentor for her. She also went to Englewood High School, which and was class of 48, and in that period, it was a really kind of robust, politically engaged intellectual community. So even though she wasn't a particularly distinguished student, she was, which is one of my favorite things about her. She didn't do well in drama. Was a voracious reader her entire life. Was very engaged in the debate society, and they talked about issues that were, in many ways, the same issues that we're talking about today with respect to in her debate organization. So you look through the program, and they're talking about issues around the Middle East. They're talking about empire. They're talking about the kind of post-war realignments and the like. And then she goes to the University of Wisconsin. One relevant detail that I left out is her father dies while she's in high school. And this is relevant because her father was a man that she described later as a real American type American. He was a patriot. He was one of the sort of black holdovers, still attached to the Republican Party. Her mother was a ward leader for the party. Her father thought that the struggle for civil rights should be done the quote unquote right way through the courts. And actually, there's a Supreme Court opinion that bears his name, Hansberry v. Lee, was decided in 1940, that was about trying to desegregate Chicago's neighborhoods or break the racially restrictive covenant and the like. But he gets to a point, despite economic success, despite his deep patriotism, where he decides that the intransigence of American racism is so intense that he cannot live here any longer. And he actually plans to leave with his family to settle in Mexico. And he goes there, buys property, and actually has a brain aneurysm and dies while there. And so part of the way that I read this is, and Lorraine talked about this later in her life, is that she saw this man who had wholly invested in the possibilities of the American project ultimately give up on it completely and decide that he had to be in exile in another country. And this is during her adolescence. And so when she makes this decision in 1948 after finishing high school not to take the conventional route of kind of bourgeois black young women of that period to go to a historically black college or university, a place like Fisk or Howard, but to go to the University of Wisconsin instead, which is both, it's a complicated political climate, but there is a lot of activism already at that point. She goes to the University of Wisconsin, she integrates a dorm. The previous black women students had to live off campus. She integrates a dorm and she becomes one of the leaders of the Progressive Party on campus. Lorraine was not particularly inclined to school though, so winds up on academic probation and then drops out and then comes back here and goes to Roosevelt for about 5 or 6 weeks and then drops out and then goes to the New School in New York and then drops out. And winds up, though, in New York in 1950, and that sort of sets her trajectory. And when she's there, she becomes a mentee of W.E.B. Du Bois and Paul Robeson, and connected to a number of figures on the black left and also kind of activists in circles in Greenwich Village as well, is a roommate at a certain point of Claudia Jones. And so she's really in this kind of robust milieu. And in that period is also, it's important to note, she was also witnessed the impact of the Cold War on all of these mentors of hers, right? And so she enters into this sort of political commitments as an artist, as well as an intellectual, well aware of the consequences, right? So as Du Bois is mentoring her, it's also a period in his life in which he is penniless because he has been essentially blacklisted. And incidentally, he described her as his favorite student. and actually enlisted her to be an educator in on one of the Jefferson School for Social Science, which was a Communist Party affiliated school. She also went after Paul Robeson's passport was revoked. She went on his behalf to a Communist Party affiliated international peace conference in Uruguay, and that was the occasion for her passport to be revoked. She lied and said she was going to spend the summer in Europe traveling around, and then when she got back, they took her passport as well. So all that to say, these political commitments actually emerge long before A Raisin in the Sun. Right? And in fact, in her FBI files, one of the things that they are trying to figure out after she writes this play is whether it has any subversive content. And so they so the FBI goes to see the play in New Haven, and they determine, oh, there's no subversive content here. It's like, actually, it's a nice, decent play. And in some ways, that actually becomes a source of great difficulty for Lorraine, because the play, because it, she decides to depict a family in as sort of natural to and authentic, although I hesitate to use that word, but a kind of true interpretation of what life was like for residents and how various people dealt with the conditions of the South Side of Chicago, it was not understood in terms of its political message and content. And once it was up on Broadway, Lorraine received, in fact, a lot of criticism from fellow members of the left who saw the play as bourgeois, who saw the play as a kind of an American dream story. And this was not as helped by reviewers who also depicted it in that way, who saw it as not a particular a particularly black play, that it was a play that was sort of just had black people in it, and she was frequently misquoted as well. In fact, a lot of the scholarship on her repeats the misquotations of her as though this is not especially black. This is just an American family, and so there's notes. She has personal notes that say, "No, never said that. Make them print retraction," right? And they never did. So she winds up in this sort of complicated position politically, and tries to spend the remaining, really, 5 years of her life, both after Raisin in the Sun becomes this extraordinary success on Broadway, the film version soon thereafter, correcting the misperception of the politics of the play, and also her having subsequent work, which cannot be misinterpreted. Interestingly, much less of that work is ever produced, and was subject to a lot more criticism. But I want to say a little bit about both the play itself and the context of her, both her organizing work and her artistic work later, to think about sort of what lessons there are in this life of someone who had a kind of remarkable prominence at a very young age, prior to age 30, and a relatively short life. She dies at age 34, and yet one that had a set of both serious commitments, but a dramatic impact, right? So the first piece that you may already know or have thought about, given what I've said prior, is that the decision to have the younger family not be like her family, but in fact be residents of a kitchenette, right, was a very explicit decision about wanting to locate the heart of sort of serious political questions as they relate to African Americans in the working class, right? It is important to think about this when Raisin in the Sun is on Broadway. This is 5 years after Brown v. Board of Education. And part of the point that Hansberry is making, her being from Chicago is incredibly relevant to this, is that one, the question of civil rights was not a regional one, it was a national one. But the two, the economic exploitation is at the foundation of it, right? So the conditions of residents of Chicago's South Side are shaped by the systematic exclusion, but also the exploitation, the very how expensive it is, as her dear friend James Baldwin say, how incredibly expensive it is to be poor, right? It's also the play, and many of the details come quite explicitly from the WPA Negro in Illinois project, about that goes into extensive detail about the economic conditions. So to have Walter Lee, for example, be a chauffeur, right, and not in the kind of alienation from the labor that his father had had engaged in, to have Beneatha be a character who was hoping to go to medical schools, reflective of when SERP camps, they started a program that was primarily for, they bought kind of nursing program, and it was supposed to be kind of, that had a pre-med component that was beginning to recruit black students in the 1940s. And so there's actually sort of a Chicago social reality that shaped her aspiration. The African student, Joseph Asagai, is shaped by the African students who she met through her uncle, William Leo Hansberry, who was a professor and really the father of African studies as a field at Howard University, who taught a number of independence movement leaders, including Nnamdi Azikiwe, the first president of Nigeria. And so part of what she was doing is actually placing various people in a set of economic conditions and social realities connected to the history of deep segregation and racial exclusion that extended in patterns of migration, as well as situation that arose from colonialism. And although oftentimes Beneatha is associated with Lorraine, she says, yes, she said she was a mess, she's like me at 19, it was really Joseph Asagai, the character who says that he believes in the religion of doing what is necessary in the world, who is her favorite character, who actually spoke many of her politics. And so one, Lorraine is without question an internationalist. Beneatha's aspirations are reflective of her feminism. She was an internationalist both vis-a-vis the history of Africa and colonialism, but also with respect to questions of Latin America. And I'm going to skip some past that, but we can come back to that in Q&A. What she does with her fame becomes incredibly instructive, I think, particularly for us now. So she goes to Uruguay in 1953. She's involved in spent time in Ajijic, Mexico before then. She's involved in a lot of political organizing. And the question after she becomes famous is, what will she do with the dynamic of actually being this sort of highly regarded writer in the midst of there still being a lot of kind of Cold War politics. And she does a series of extraordinary things. One is that I'm fascinated by is that when JFK is part of the Cold War policy of the United States, creates this African airlift program where essentially the idea is that if we bring a lot of African students here to be educated in the United States, then they won't become communist or socialist countries. The two people who are selected to be the people who are going to sort of acclimate them to the United States are Lorraine Hansberry and Malcolm X, which is a little
score.
Right. And so I spent this time thinking, like, you know, what was JFK thinking at this moment? And a piece of it, without question, had to do with who the students wanted to meet, right? And so I think, given that the history of black radical internationalism is so muted and actually evacuated in both in our kind of public discourses and even in academic discourses, right, that doesn't automatically come to people's mind as a reality, but it's without question true. And you know, Chinua Achebe asked to meet Lorraine Hansberry when he came to the States. There's a history of connection. A number of the people who she was involved with politically become expatriates and go to Ghana. So that's a piece of that history. But it's also the case that without question, the State Department knew who she was and what her politics were. And so you see this kind of complicated dance, I think, between sort of wanting her to be a spokesperson for the United States and the reality of her politics. And perhaps this is most dramatically illustrated by the famous 1963 RFK meeting, which you may or may not know about it. I'll just describe it. Birmingham, Alabama, which is my hometown, so I'm particularly proud of it, in 1963 had caused great consternation to the U.S. government because of protests. And there was concern, and this is very familiar, that the protests might mess up the election, so people should stop protesting. Right? We can hear that all the time. RFK said to James Baldwin, bring some of your friends and I'm going to talk to them at the Kennedy apartment on Central Park West. And so there was Lorraine Hansberry and Lena Horne and Harry Belafonte and a number of people who were there. And the idea was they were going to get these prominent black people to tell black folks in Birmingham to calm down. Which is a bad plan. So, for a number of reasons, not the least of which is that there was not, as Martin Luther King Jr. learned, people from outside were not gonna tell black people in Birmingham what to do. Anyway, so they have this meeting, and the meeting, everybody is kind of timid initially. And at one point, Jerome Smith, who was a civil rights activist in CORE, who was only in New York because he had been beaten so badly by police in Mississippi that he needed major surgery. And he's at the meeting. And he says something, and he actually starts talking about foreign policy of the United States and how he could not possibly legitimately fight on behalf of the United States given the way that they, the imperialism around the globe and their failure to offer basic protection to civil rights workers. And Robert F. Kennedy is dismissive of him. And this incenses Lorraine. And she says, she essentially says, you're being deferential and kind to all the famous people, but that's the person you really need to listen to, the organizer, right? And then she goes into she launches into an argument, and Baldwin said he was like, she was so tiny, but she seemed like she took up the entire room. And flips the conversation, right? Says, one, the people in Birmingham speak for us, right? And two, we want a moral commitment from you on civil rights. And then she leads everybody out of the room. And the papers the next day say, the meeting was a failure, right? So it's quite interesting that there's a kind of media coverage almost immediately. But one thing that does happen is that within several months, JFK starts talking about civil rights in terms of a moral commitment, which he had not before. So there's an impact of that meeting, and it's illustrative of her position in which she decided to take advantage of the relative prominence she had to be outspoken on issues of justice in a variety of ways, as opposed to attempting to maintain the rewards of access and relative privilege. Another example is she purchased a home in Croton-on-Hudson, which was a kind of enclave in the Hudson Valley that had historically had lots of artists and lefties, and she purchased a home near what was called Red Hill. And I just gave a talk up there recently. And she, in Croton, she led a fundraiser in 1964. Hansberry was actually not particularly interested in the mainstream civil rights movement initially. She was very critical of Martin Luther King Jr. and like sort of charismatic models of leadership, but also and the sort of male leader model. And she and also kind of just sort of the litigation strategy or the mass mobilization strategy. But it was actually SNCC that inspired her, SNCC and CORE, and more of the direct action protest that inspired her and actually really intrigued her about the Southern movement. And she was gave money to SNCC, and she also did fundraising. She did various writing projects on their behalf and the like. She organized a rally in Croton and raised a good deal of money. And that money was used to purchase a car, a station wagon, that actually was the station wagon that Goodman, Schwerner, and Cheney were driving when they were murdered. And there is, there's a piece of her life that is, I think, instructive and also heartbreaking, which is, and there's an indication of it actually right after the Kennedy meeting in 1963. Baldwin sees her after the meeting. He's in a car with Kenneth Clark to do an interview, the man who, you know, with his wife Mamie, who did the doll studies that were the foundation of the Brown v. Board of Education opinion. And he sees her from the car, and she doesn't see him, and he sees that she's holding her stomach. And that 1963 is really the beginning of the cancer that would take her life. So, and she's not told until the very end that she's going to die, as was standard, right? A medical practice, you can tell people that they were dying. And so one of the things is she had this series of illnesses that she was told, oh, I have ulcers and I have this, and she knew that she was kind of in desperate condition. She also was struggling with the fact that she couldn't go down south and become an organizer. And one of the questions, one of the ways that she framed this is she said, I thought of myself as a revolutionary, but I want to go down south to see what kind of revolutionary I could actually be, right? And it is her body, the fragility of her body, that keeps her from testing the set of convictions that she has. But I'm so moved by the fact, the idea that it reminded me actually when I first read it of Maya Angelou used to say, you know, all these people walking around saying they're Christians. She said, I think that's so funny. Like, I'm trying to be a Christian. And I think that there's an analogy there with being on the left, right? You can proclaim a series of positions, but what does it mean to actually be, right? Committed to the politics. And so, so that's a question she asked herself, and it seemed to her ultimately not sufficient to simply say these are my commitments, but actually wanting to put them in practice. There's another piece. I'm going to talk just quickly about two more things that I think are really relevant, and then hopefully we can have something of a discussion. One is there was an important forum that was called the Black Revolution and the White Backlash in New York in 1964 that she participated in. And it's actually the forum in which she talked about her father's dying as a bitter expatriate in Mexico, right? But in the midst of it, she says, our task is to change the white liberal into an American radical. And I was incredibly moved by this, I think particularly in the light of this historic moment, and it connects for me to Tony Cade Bambara's statement that the job of the writer is to make revolution irresistible, right? That the task is actually one to be engaged in community in ways that lead to the transformation of sensibilities. And so often, I think these days, and I say we because I wind up being, I'm self-critical in this regard, there's a kind of tendency to rest on the laurels of our being correct politically, as opposed to thinking about what is the process of transformation that we have to engage in with our communities. And understanding that the process of transformation is not an evangelical mission, it's actually a connective tissue, right? It's how we exist in communities. And I think that was, and so I take that to be her continued legacies, to think, and so she spoke to it, but she also tried to embody it, and she tried to create art and to write essays and to share ideas that had that potential for transformation. And the last thing that I'll say is, another one of the poignant moments for me in writing the book is actually writing about the immediate aftermath of the March on Washington. So Lorraine couldn't be at the March on Washington because she was sick and she was in the hospital. She watched it on television, 1963 March on Washington. But her mentor, W.E.B. Du Bois, died the night before. And then several months later, there was a memorial for him in New York, which she spoke at. And her words there were quite potent. She talked about the intellectual significance of Du Bois as the most sort of impactful intellectual in the African-American tradition, father of American sociology, et cetera, et cetera. But she also said, and she said this to the audience quite directly, she said, you know, all of these people, because there was a wide political perspective celebrating Du Bois, you can see that today too. Some people like the talented 10th Du Bois, and some people like the socialist Du Bois. But what she said is, she said, all of this praise, and all of this praise, we cannot forget that Du Bois, what undergirded his ideas was his belief in the socialist organization of the society. And I think that that's something that, I mean, for me certainly is analogous to what was important for me in writing this book, but I think that it's also important for us, as we consistently use history to tell our present, to also make explicit those commitments, particularly those of people whose work has been submerged and whose ideas have been submerged even as they have been celebrated. I'm going to stop there. Thanks so much.